Brother Stephen Snoblin's theme for today is Biblical Perspectives on the Environment. This is his second class entitled The Environment in the Law of Moses.
Okay, I'm going to have to pick up speed a little bit, otherwise we won't get through our material. So what we want to do is want to say a little bit about Genesis creation, and we're going to move on and talk about some of the things that relate to the law of Moses, including engaging with that portion of text that we've just had read. Okay, now, some of you may remember a number of years ago, back in 2006, I did a study day here on the Genesis account of creation. So one or two of these points will maybe be familiar to you already. And one of them is what you're looking at right now. This is the structure, the literary structure, if you will, of the Genesis account of creation. The reason why I'm showing this to you is because it gives us more information than just the linear narrative. Because when we look at the way the Genesis account of creation is structured, we can see that there are parallels between days 1 and 4, 2 and 5, and 3 and 6. These are important because of what they tell us. They tell us that there is foresight in this creative project, that certain things have to come before other things. So you need to have a sea before you have sea creatures. You need to have the sky before you have sky creatures. You have to have land before you have land creatures, right? So there's a sense of purpose. There's a sense of order. But also, we get a sense from this structure, two triads, a dual triadic structure, that there is an interconnectedness in nature. And we'll eventually talk about this, but in the history of science, the roots of the study of the environment, the roots of what we call ecology, include as a substantial component some Christian or biblical ideas. And this involves people like Linnaeus, who was the one who came up with the binomial nomenclature system that we use in our taxonomies for plants and animals, etc. But this idea in the Genesis account of creation that there is order and that there is interconnectedness, that you have what we could call, using modern language, habitats, right? 1, 2, 3, and inhabitants in 4, 5, and 6. This idea takes us right back to the Genesis account of creation, which, of course, is a foundational text not only for us, but actually for Western culture as a whole. Even though Western culture is now quite secular, this is still a foundation text. And therefore, at my own university, we have a history of ideas or a great books program that the first-year students take, and they read the Bible. They read Genesis, and they read Exodus, and they read portions from the New Testament, etc. Because whether one's a believer or not, these texts, these biblical texts, had a very profound shaping role on Western culture and on Western ideas. And this includes science and in particular with respect to our theme today, ecology. Okay, so this is important. And this is just a variation of this structure where I have a little X there. Showing that the order sky to sea is reversed in day 5 when you compare it to day 2. And this actually sets up a chiasm, which is what you often see in the Hebrew Bible. You actually see it in the New Testament occasionally as well, which just reinforces the structure. Something else that is worth noting, just in passing, because it is such an important biblical theme, is that you'll see when you look at the parallels between days 3 and 6 that grass and trees are parallel with human beings. And we've already looked at an example in Psalm 1 where you see that, where humans are compared to trees. Now, usually when humans are compared to trees, it's a positive comparison. Whereas when humans are compared to grass, it's usually a negative comparison that speaks to the fleeting nature of life, our mortality, you know, all flesh is as grass, etc., etc. But this analogy is partly rooted in the very structure of the Genesis account of creation. So what does the structure tell us? It tells us that nature is ordered, obviously divinely ordered. It's interconnected. The harmonies exist in nature, and teleologies exist in nature. What is a teleology? Well, teleology is just the idea that there's a goal in something. Something's aiming for something. So when you design an engine for an automobile, it's designed for a purpose. It's designed to make a car go. So when you see certain structures in nature, you can see that they are designed for a purpose. So all of this comes out of the Genesis account of creation, and it's very, very important in the development of the history of science as well. Okay. Now, something else that's structural that comes out of Genesis chapter 1 and Genesis 2 is a series of what I'm going to call concentric rings that show our relationship with the rest of creation. Now, this is an important point that I'm going to stress over the next few minutes, and that is that we as human beings are part of creation, right? We are part of creation. Much of the same language that's used of our physiological existence is also used of animals, right? And yet at the same time, only humans are described as having the image of God, right? So it's as if there's an X and Y axes of humanness, that we have this connection with the animals, which is our horizontal relationship, and then we have a vertical relationship with God. And that relationship is not shared with the animals. So we're the same as the animals, but we have this distinction. So it's not an either-or thing, as you often hear people say. Now, there is a verb, a creation verb, that's only used with God as the subject, and it's bara. And you see it used in Genesis 1, and I'm just going to show you where it is. So there's bara right there. And then it's used when it says God created whales. And that's not the only possible interpretation, but probably large sea mammals are in view. So there it is right there. And then it's used when God creates human beings, and there it is there, bara. It's actually used three times, which in Hebrew is emphatic, right? So what's going on here? Well, the text is setting up, again, what I've described as concentric rings. There's more than one way of diagramming this. This is just the way I've done it. So you have the initial creation of the physical world, and then you have the creation of animate world, so soulish creatures, so breathing beings, the nefesh chaya, breathing beings. And we're part of that, right? We're part of the physical creation. We're also part of animate creation. But moral creation is the human being, right? And that is only us. We don't share our ability to have morals, to know the difference between right and wrong, one of the big themes that comes out of Genesis 2 and 3. And we don't share our religious capabilities with animals, right? We alone are religiously capable. Now, of course, again, you know, one shouldn't be proud or boastful about these things, because they also bring with them a great deal of responsibility. So these concentric rings are marked out by this very special verb, bara. And then when we go to Genesis 2, we actually see something similar. This is why I argue that Genesis 1 and 2 are connected. Some argue that they come from completely different time periods. Well, they're certainly connected. They're certainly in dialogue with each other, because you can see a lot of the same themes coming up, even though there are certain differences in presentation. So what do you see? Well, you see Eden is the local physical environment, and then you see animals, and humans, again, are within that sphere. They're animals. They come out of the ground, but only the humans are given instructions about not eating of a certain tree, etc. You don't see that instruction given to animals. So only humans are expected to be moral. And you can see as well that man is brought to Eden, and then the animals are brought to the man, and then the woman eventually brought to the man. So there are various ways in which these concentric rings are marked out. So why talk about this? Well, I want to, again, just emphasize that we're part of creation. We're created beings. We're physical. We're part of the earth. We come out of the earth, And when we die, we go back to the earth. And that language is also used of animals. And yet at the same time, we alone are described as having the image of God. And we alone are given the commandments in Genesis 2, which are also similar to the commandment of dominion, which is given in chapter 1, instructions, mandates to care for the garden, etc. That language is not used of animals, right? So this places us in a unique position in the environment because we're part of the environment, we're affected by the environment, but we alone can consciously do right or wrong in the environment. Okay. A very, very important verse in the Bible, I think it's maybe in the top 10, is Genesis 2, verse 7, in terms of what it tells us about who we are, human nature. So in Genesis 2, verse 7, in the King James, we have, "And the Lord God formed man," and then we have this word, ha-adam, or just Adam. So ha is the definite article in Hebrew. The man. Now, later, it becomes a proper name. So Adam with a capital A. But Adam is just human. It's just the standard word for human. It's used for all kinds of people in the Bible. And the human is created out of the dust of the ha-adama, right? So adama is ground. So our name basically means ground. That's what we're from. We're from the ground. But then something very special happens. God breathed into the man's nostrils the breath of life. And this term neshama is used. And in the Hebrew of Genesis 2, verse 7, is nishmat chaim. And man then becomes a living soul. Now, the King James has living soul, right? And there's a problem with this word soul because it means so many different things to so many different people. And obviously, it has a Platonic connotation for many people that it's this immaterial thing that departs the body at death. One thing you'll notice, if you look at modern translations, almost all modern translations, when they translate Genesis 2, verse 7, do not use the word soul. There's various reasons for that. And one is that what I've just said. It means so many different things to so many different people. It has a lot of baggage. It's actually unhelpful to put that word in there because it, for many people, means a Platonic soul. And of all the things it could mean, Platonic soul is clearly not one of them. But Christians over the ages have tended to read this text as if it's an infusing of a soul within us, right? And this is part of, it's one of the backdrops to this critique that people make against Christianity and the environment. They say, well, you know, you believe you have a soul that's going to leave the earth, and, you know, the earth is evil, your body is evil. It sounds like Gnosticism, right? We've talked about that already. The Bible doesn't teach that, right? Yes, many Christians do teach that, but that's not part of the biblical teaching. So the Jewish Publication Society, Tanakh, just translates Nefesh Chaya as living being. We see something else, and I've already alluded to this, that in Genesis 2, humans, vegetation, and animals all come from Adama, right? They all come from the ground. Ultimately, they all return to the ground, right? We're organic, just like plants and animals. Vegetation does not have breath, but animals have breath, so they share that with us, but not vegetation. Now, interestingly enough, the word human, which comes from the Latin, has a similar dynamic to the word Adam, which is the Hebrew word for human, insofar as human is cognate with humus, right, which is organic matter that you would have in soil, right? And so in Latin and in English, by virtue of the Latin that's entered the English language, we have the same thing going on between the word for human and the word for soil or organic matter. It's just a reminder of our humble origins. That's what we are. God formed the first man out of the ground, out of Adama. And so what we are is we're physical beings, but we're animated with the breath of life. This is all physical, right? There's no immaterial entity there at all. So that's the biblical perspective. So the materiality of living creatures, we come from the earth and we return to the earth. Living creatures are made up of the stuff of the earth and are thus material beings. Living creatures are thus physically united with the earth and the material world. And to confirm this, the Bible speaks of both animals and humans not only coming from the earth, but becoming earth again at death. And we see this, for example, in Ecclesiastes chapter 3, verses 19 to 20. Okay, so this is what I referred to earlier, the horizontal relationship. We have a horizontal relationship with the created world around us. We're both humans and animals are created. In the biblical account, we're situated on the terrestrial plane of existence. In other words, you know, we're not angels, we're not in heaven, we're on the earth. Humans, animals, and plants, all described as being made out of the ground, exactly the same Hebrew word, minha adama, used of all three. Humans and animals gain nourishment from vegetation, which in turn comes from the... These are all physical things. And the description of a living being in Hebrew, nefesh chaya, is literally a living, breathing thing. And this helps explain why in the Bible you can have a dead nefesh, right? Nefesh is the word that's translated soul. You can't have a dead nefesh if nefesh means a Platonic soul, because Platonic souls can't die, right? So there's a problem there, but that's not what the Bible is teaching. So when we look at the way the word nefesh is used, and again, it's interesting when we compare the King James older translations with newer translations to see what translators have been doing with this word. So here I have three examples of where nefesh is used as a pronoun. Pronominal is just the word for the adjective for pronoun. So in Genesis... sorry, we have three different translations here, the same text. Genesis 27:19, sit and eat of my venison that my soul may bless me. Right? Well, this is, even with the word soul there, it's clearly a physical thing that's being talked about here. The NIV and the JPS Tanakh both translate nefesh as with a pronoun, you, second person pronoun. And that's generally what you see in modern translations because it's not talking about a soul. So here's another example, Deuteronomy 6, verse 5, and thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and with all thy soul, right, in the King James, that's nefesh, and with all thy might. And then in this Jewish translation, the Shochan Bible, you are to love Yahweh your God with all your heart, with all your being. So here it's translated as being, the human being as a living entity with all your substance. And then there's this interesting footnote on Deuteronomy 6 and 5. The word heart, the word is often equivalent to mind in biblical language. Being is the translation of Hebrew nefesh, right? It sometimes is transliterated with an F, sometimes with a PH, but it's the same word. And it carries a lot of meanings. Life or life essence, breath, self, and appetite, to mention a few. The traditional English soul, while stirring in these passages, you know, in a literary sense, gives the impression of something contrasted to the body, not an idea that appears in the Hebrew Bible. It should be mentioned that the couplet heart and being, which occurs a number of times in Deuteronomy, might also indicate mind and emotions. Right? So, again, modern scholarship is saying there's no immortal soul, that we are entirely physical. And this is an important part of our theme. So, philosophers and theologians debate, you know, is the human being an animated body or an incarnated soul, right? Incarnation, carne, Latin word for flesh, so going into flesh is what that means. So that's how many people interpreted Genesis 2 verse 7 over the years, including some Jewish rabbis as well, that what is being described there is God infusing into Adam a soul, a Platonic immaterial soul that can survive the body. When in fact the text is saying nothing of the sort. So the Hebraic idea, the biblical idea, is that we're animated bodies. In other words, we're bodies animated with the breath of life. And when we're dead, we're not breathing anymore, but the body is still there, at least for a while. And then the other view, the Platonic view, or the view that's named after René Descartes, who had this dualistic view of the human, that we are two things. We're a soul and a body conjoined together. That is the other view, but it's clearly not the view that we see in the Bible. And so again, philosophers and theologians speak about two options with respect to the human. And one of them, and apologize for these highfalutin terms, I've rated some of these slides from some of my lectures. Aspective is the idea that human is one thing consisting of non-separable aspects. And then partitive is the idea that the human consists of separable parts, and that's the Platonic view. There's a separable part, the soul, that can leave the body in an out-of-body experience or a near-death experience, or ultimately a death, right? It's a very well-known movie, Heaven is for Real, I think it's called, came out earlier this year, which is all about that, you can leave your body, you can float above your body, et cetera, et cetera. That's not the biblical view. The biblical view is that we are entirely physical. And so all the way back in 1925, we see H. Wheeler Robinson encapsulating the biblical idea. The Hebrew idea of personality is an animated body, not an incarnated soul. Now, something else that we see when we look at the Genesis account of creation is a progressive intimacy in the creation of life mentioned in Genesis 1 and in Genesis 2. Here we have Genesis 1. So we see the description of vegetation made out of the earth. There's no creation verb used there. The language of God is indirect, whereas with fish, whales being created in the waters, you have the word bara, and then the description of God actually doing this. Same with birds. Animals is a different verb made. And then with humans, you have both creation verbs, asa and bara. You have the addition of the image of God and likeness of God, which is only mentioned of humans. And then you have three creation verbs used of the human. So it's almost like there's a continuum here. All are creation, all are created, all are creation, but there's something special about the human being. And you see something very similar in Genesis chapter 2. The creation verbs are now different. Yatsar, which is the word for form, it's the word that's used of potters, making something out of clay, which is kind of interesting, because essentially that's what you have when Adam, the first man, is being created. It's God as a potter, right? And then you have this inbreathing, which is not mentioned with any animal. So again, it's not an either-or thing. We're physical, just like the rest of life, but there are these special things said about human beings, and those things bring with them responsibilities. So here are some of the things. I'll just very briefly mention some of them. Image of God, spiritual capabilities. We are religiously capable. We alone are given dominion and the ability to control nature. And we have this responsibility in the form of stewardship. And stewardship is something that we're going to enlarge upon as we move on this weekend. We touched on some of these already. The verb "let us make" is only used of humans in Genesis 1, signaling extra prayer in their creation. Humans are the only ones who can obey a moral law. The animals can obey natural laws of nature and that sort of thing, almost by instinct. But humans obey moral law by choice. They obey it or not by choice. That's only set of humans, and so it's only humans who can have the fall as they did in Genesis chapter 3. And only humans can enter consciously into covenants, although animals are involved in covenants in the account of Noah's flood. Only humans can enter those in a conscious way. And again, this ability to control nature for good or for ill consciously is something that only humans possess. All right, so we have this vertical relationship as well, and that is with God, a relationship that's not shared with the rest of creation. So here's the passage that a lot of people focus in on with respect to this argument that the dominion that's granted to human beings is domination, that we're given a license to dominate nature. And God said, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth." So God created man, there's that word Adam, in his own image, in the image of God created he him, male and female created he them. That's set out in poetry, because it is actually poetry in the Hebrew. And God blessed them and said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth," or fill the earth, is what the Hebrew actually means, "and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over every living thing that moveth upon the earth." And God said, "Behold, I have given you every herb bearing seed which is upon the face of the earth, and every tree in the which is the fruit of a tree yielding seed. To you it shall be for meat or for food. And to every beast of the earth, and to every fowl of the air, and to every thing that creepeth upon the earth, wherein there is life, I have given every green herb for meat." And it was so. So on Sunday night, when we come back to this topic, I'll mention that there was a medieval historian named Lynn White Jr. who published a paper in the Science Journal, which is just called Science, very famous. It's still in existence today. So he published this paper in 1967, which is called the Lynn White thesis. And he argues in that paper that it's this notion of dominion, and particularly how it was interpreted, that has brought us to this ecologic crisis, as he called it. So for many people, including Lynn White, this is a serious problem, this passage. Well, one of the first things that we need to say about this is that it needs to be seen in context. And the context includes Genesis chapter 2. And when we look at Genesis chapter 2, we see that God is a model for the human beings. God is a gardener. God plants the garden. He plants the trees, right? And God has stewardship over creation. Now, God is not despoiling the earth, destroying the earth. He's caring for it. He creates it and he cares for it. It's a very precious thing to him. So if the dominion that humans have, which is a delegated dominion, right, from God, is in any way related to the kind of dominion that God has, and if we are to follow his example, then it's going to be a benign stewardship, right? The other passage that we need to bear in mind is Genesis 2 and 15. And the Lord God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to dress it and to keep it. And I'm going to show you three other translations of that passage. So the ESV has work it and keep it. The translation called God's Word has farm the land and take care of it. And the ISV, the International Standard Version, has work it and guard it. And what we see, and we're going to talk about this again more particularly on Sunday night, is that this is the language of serving and preserving the garden. The garden, despite what a lot of people think when they think of the Garden of Eden, is not a wild space. It's not wilderness. It is a human-managed space, right? And one thing that biologists and others have been discovering over the years is that places that we often consider to be completely wild, like the Amazon rainforest, for hundreds of years were actually farmed and managed by the native populations there. They sometimes made mistakes, and there were sometimes ecological catastrophes, this is something that has been discovered. It came as a great surprise to me to hear a lecturer mention this a few years ago, and I attended a lecture at my university. But this is, in fact, the case. So we often think of Eden, and we often describe, you know, a wilderness as if it's a pristine Eden. Well, Eden is a human-managed space. And so when we listen to people talking about the environment, you will often hear different models for how to engage with the environment. And so one model is the hands-off model, just leave it alone model, right? And so there are some who are involved in what is called the deep ecology movement who say that that's what we need to do. In other words, nothing. We just back away and we let nature, we just leave it alone and it'll repair itself. Unfortunately, in some places, nature has been so badly damaged that it can only be repaired by human beings. Well, that's not the model that the Bible presents. Yes, there are areas we can see in the Bible that are deemed as sort of wilderness and places where wild animals live and that sort of thing. But certainly in the case of the Garden of Eden, the model is a benign stewardship. So we're called to work in the world, not to destroy it, but to serve it and preserve it. Okay, so now we shift gears and go to the Law of Moses. Hopefully most of you have the handout, which goes over in more detail than I've had time to present. The material that we looked at in Genesis, for example, as well as some others, including a short section on the Law of Moses. Let me just mention in passing, because Yes, it is actually on your handout. Noah's flood. Some of you, maybe a few of you, may be aware that earlier this year there was a Hollywood movie about Noah's flood. In many respects, on biblical and extra-biblical material, and it, I don't want to deal with that. But the point is that, and we'll talk about this on Sunday night, is that Noah's flood is increasingly being used by environmentalists as a kind of metaphor for preserving creation. And one of the points that's often made, and I think it might be in the handout, is, yes, that Noah and his family preserved the unclean animals as well as the clean animals. In other words, they preserved animals that had no immediate value to human beings for food or as, you know, beasts of burden or whatever. So suggesting that, you know, these other animals had intrinsic value and that therefore were worthy of preserving. So it's interesting. I mean, you know, Hollywood is Hollywood, but the point is that even in this increasingly secular age, we can see that some people, including those in the environmental movement, find that some of these biblical themes actually resonate with the environment. This despite the argument that we've mentioned earlier that the Bible's actually hostile towards the environment, right? So we're seeing both, which is kind of interesting. All right, the Law of Moses gives us more material to discuss and to think about. One of the things that we see in the description of the tabernacle, and we see this, and I'll mention this a bit later, we talk about the law, or sorry, the prophets, is that there is some symbolism and imagery that relates to nature. Generally speaking, you don't have imagery of animals. Yes, you do have cherubim, but instead you have depictions of trees, palm trees in particular, and flowers. And so the menorah is an example where you have descriptions of flowers. So the flower at the top would be the lantern, and the very language of branches is suggestive of some tree or plant. And this particular example right here, the people who put together this image are arguing that the menorah is modeled after the almond tree. Another argument is that it's modeled after the menorah plant, often also called the Moriah plant, which is found in Israel. And sometimes it has seven branches or nine, but it does look a little bit like the menorah. Is that the case or not? I don't know. I'm just suggesting it. Again, the ancient Israelites were very close to nature, and so maybe there is something in that. Okay. I want to draw your attention to some passages that talk about the Sabbaths, two types. So we have the land Sabbath, which we'll get to in a few minutes, and the weekly Sabbath. So let's go to Exodus chapter 20 and verses 10 to 11. Exodus 20, 10 to 11. This is obviously the Ten Commandments. But the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord. Where does this begin? Well, it's the seventh day of creation, right? At the beginning of chapter 2 of Genesis. So again, Genesis is foundational. But the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. And on it you shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter or your male servant or your female servant or your livestock or the sojourner who is within your gates. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea, and all that is in them, and rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. Well, obviously God doesn't need to rest, but God is once again the model for how we act. God worked for 6 days and then he rested. So we have, for the first time in the ancient world, this sanctioned in the legal code with very strict punishments if you broke the commandment, this day of rest. But it's important to note that servants were also supposed to rest. So it wasn't just those who were free. Now, Exodus 23, just moving over a few chapters, and verse 12 gives us an added detail. 6 days shall you do your work, but on the seventh day you shall rest, that your ox and your donkey may have rest, and the son of your servant woman and the alien may be refreshed. And then finally, Deuteronomy chapter 5 and verse 14. But the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter or your male servant or your female servant or your ox or your donkey or any of your livestock or the sojourner who is within your gates, that your male servant and your female servant may rest as well as you. So we see in this provision of the Sabbath day of rest, which of course is, to us is Saturday, right, that it is extended not only to the freeborn, as it were, Israelites, but also to the bondservants and to the animals, right? So we see here a concern for animal welfare. Okay, planting trees. This is a description of planting trees in Leviticus 19 and verse 23. When you come into the land and plant any kind of tree for food, then you shall regard its fruit as forbidden. 3 years it shall be forbidden to you. It must not be eaten. And in the fourth year, all of its fruit shall be holy, an offering of praise to the Lord. But in the fifth year, you may eat of its fruit to increase its yield for you. I am the Lord your God. Well, a couple things here. One is that they're planting trees, right? Not cutting them down. Number two, this is just good husbandry, right? Not taking from the fruit until the tree is more mature. Now, I said they're not cutting down trees, but there are references to cutting down trees in the Law of Moses. And one notable one is in Deuteronomy chapter 20, verses 19 to 20. This is a verse that's much discussed by scholars, and I'm sure most of you are familiar with it as well. Well, I said verse, but actually there are two verses here. Deuteronomy 20, starting at verse 19. When you besiege a city for a long time, making war against it in order to take it, you shall not destroy its trees by wielding an axe against them. You may eat from them, but you shall not cut them down. Are the trees in the field human? It's interesting, again, we see this comparison between trees and humans, that they should be besieged by you. Only the trees that you know are not trees for food you may destroy and cut down, that you may build siege works against the city that makes war with you until it falls. Now, it's interesting, in rabbinic interpretation, one of the principles of rabbinic interpretation is that you take a specific example like this and then you enlarge upon it. And so we see in rabbinical interpretation this belief that fruit trees are very precious, right? You plant them, you don't cut them down, right? They provide for human beings, but also more largely trees in general, that you plant trees. And I'll show you some examples on Sunday night where some of the ancient rabbis are saying one of the best things you can do is plant trees, right? So the rabbis as the first tree huggers, if you will. There are other examples in the Law of Moses of directions for the humane treatment of animals in Exodus 23 and Leviticus 25, Deuteronomy 22 and Deuteronomy 25. And so we see in the Law of Moses this understanding that you should treat your animals humanely and kindly, etc. So that's something that also relates to our larger theme. Now, I want to talk about the Shemitah. Now, the word Shemitah is actually biblical. It is the word release. And it's found in Deuteronomy 15 and verse 1. So the year of release is the land Sabbath. But it's not just a land Sabbath. It's also a year of economic release, when debts are forgiven. It's when there is, if you will, an economic reset button that is pressed, right? And then something similar happens in the Jubilee year, which is either the 49th or the 50th year. Scholars debate that point. But so it's kind of like a super year of Jubilee. So we see in the Shemitah, the release, not only the principle that the land needs to rest, just like human beings, except in this case, you know, it's every seventh year for an entire year, but that's certain economic burdens on the more disadvantaged sector of the population need to be relieved, right? Now imagine if our society operated on that basis. Well, one of the outcomes would be that you wouldn't have such a disparity between the wealthy and the poor, right? Because it would be a lot harder for the wealthy to accumulate wealth on the backs of those less well-off. And in fact, archaeologists have shown in their studies of ancient Israelite homes that the ancient Israelites lived in what we would call an egalitarian society. They almost all had the same four-room structure for a home. There were wealthy people, and you do occasionally hear about wealthy people in both the Old Testament and the New Testament. And some of those were righteous, but nevertheless, it was much more of an egalitarian society. Okay, so the year of release, the agricultural land Sabbath. Let's go to Exodus 23. And now, actually, just to make it simpler, let's go to our reading, which was Leviticus 25, starting at verse 1. It comes up several times, but Leviticus 25 gives us the fullest account. So you have the Sabbath year, verses 1 to 7, and then you have the year of Jubilee starting in verse 8. By the way, our word Jubilee comes from the Hebrew word that's translated Jubilee here. So the principle is that you work your crops, you operate your vineyards and your olive groves. So these would be three examples, your fields, your vineyards, and your olive groves for 6 years. And then the seventh year, you let them lie fallow. And people could just wander into your vineyards and pick grapes. As long as they weren't harvesting them, you know, in large bushels, you could do that. And this allows the land to regenerate, right? The cropland to regenerate, et cetera. But it also allowed the Israelites to have a year off from agricultural work, which could be devoted to spiritual renewal as well. Okay, and then again, as I said, in Leviticus 25, starting at verse 8, you have the year of Jubilee, which is a lot of the same principles. You have debt release, you have the land lying fallow, etc. So that's in addition to every 7 years. Now, one of the sad things about the Shemitah is that it seems that it wasn't often kept. How do we know that? Well, let's look at 2 Chronicles 36. 2 Chronicles 36. So this brings us to the end of the kingdom of Judah, the lead up to the Babylonian captivity. 2 Chronicles 36 and 21. Start at verse 20. He took into exile in Babylon those who had escaped from the sword, and they became servants to him and his sons until the establishment of the kingdom of Persia, to fulfill the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah until the land had enjoyed its Sabbaths. All the days that it lay desolate, it kept Sabbath to fulfill 70 years. So this is a 70-year captivity. So let's just think about this a little bit. 70 years, if 70 Sabbath years were missed, this is a period of almost 500 years, right? So if the captivity, if we take 605 BC to be the beginning of the captivity, and we go back 500 years, that takes us to the end of the period of the judges, right? So if this is true, if this is meant to be taken absolutely literally, rather than, you know, that they generally didn't keep it, that they never kept it, then it takes us back to the end of the period of the judges. So it wasn't kept at all during the time of the kings. But God is making sure that the land does keep its Sabbath. Leviticus 26 and verse 32. Leviticus 26, 32. And I myself will, if the Israelites are unfaithful, I myself will devastate the land so that your enemies who settle in it will be appalled by it. And I will scatter you among the nations, and I will unsheath the sword after you, and your land shall become a desolation, and your cities a waste. Then the land shall enjoy its Sabbath, as long as it lies desolate, while you are in your enemy's land. Then the land shall rest and enjoy its Sabbath. As long as it lies desolate, it shall have rest, the rest that it did not have on your Sabbath when you were dwelling in it. And then we jump to verse 43. But the land shall be abandoned by them and enjoy its Sabbaths while it lies desolate without them. And they shall make amends for their iniquity because they spurned my rules and their soul abhorred my statutes. Okay, so the land needed its Sabbaths. The people weren't giving it its Sabbaths. So God intervened and the land had its Sabbaths. 70 years of missed Sabbaths. And we read about the 7-year captivity in Jeremiah chapter 25 and verse 11, and Jeremiah 29 and verse 10. All right, we need to wrap up. What I want to say at the end of this session is that the Shemitah has actually been revived in Israel. Some of you may be aware of this. It's very interesting. And so here we have the Israeli Shemitah declaration. That Hebrew up there just says Shemitah Yisraelit, so it's the Israeli Shemitah. And the reference there, they kind of avoid using biblical language because people involved in the Shemitah revival are both religious and non-religious. But it is referred to as the ancient mandate of Shemitah, which obligates all farmers in the land of Israel once every 7 years to leave their fields fallow, relinquish ownership, and produce and let the soil rest. That's right. So if you were renting property from someone else at the end of the 6 years, it would go back to the original family. So you don't have the accumulation of wealth. That's another aspect of it. And so in Israel, and it's actually on a very large scale. A lot of farmers are practice this in some way, and also debt release is part of the package. So earlier this year, they had a meeting of the Israeli Knesset to establish a number of principles for the Shemitah year, which, by the way, began in late September, right, of this year. So we're in a Shemitah year right now, which is the Jewish year 5775, which corresponds to 2014-2015. What did the Israeli members of parliament do? Well, they said, we want to reinforce this notion of the Shemitah. They want to extend it to the Sea of Galilee, to have a moratorium on fishing, to allow the fish stocks to recover. The Israeli welfare ministry allocated 70 million new Israeli shekels, to help 10,000 Israeli families with debt relief. So that's part of what the biblical Shemitah year is supposed to do. And the Israeli education minister stated that education about the practice of Shemitah would be introduced in both secular and religious schools in the upcoming Shemitah year. So you can find all kinds of material about the practice of the Shemitah, including this very large book. I think it's 160 pages or something like that, about the Shemitah. There you see the Hebrew word for Shemitah. Here is a sign in modern Israeli Hebrew cursive, which says that the grapes and the other crops on this man's property are now ownerless. It is a Shemitah year, and people can walk in and pick the fruit themselves. As long as they're not harvesting it, just pick enough for them to eat. Right? This is today, right? This is 2014. Now, human nature being what it is, some Israelis have found workarounds. So I'll tell you two workarounds. One of them is that you sell your property to an Arab who doesn't keep the Shemitah year for the Shemitah year. So therefore, you don't own the land, so it can be harvested just as normal. And that's been around for decades, that one. Another workaround is you grow food hydroponically, elevated on benches with a tarp covering the earth, so there's no contact between the hydroponically grown vegetation there. In this case, it's lettuce. And so this, and as you can see, it's a very religious Jew is saying he's not disobeying the Shemitah year because it doesn't apply to things grown in greenhouses. So, you know, we see this kind of thing in ancient Israel. We see it in the New Testament, that human nature wants to avoid some of the strictures of God's laws, and so they come up with ways of doing it. I don't think this is something that God, this kind of thinking is something that God would approve of. In any case, there you have it. For the most part, it's actually a flourishing practice now in Israel. It's an environmental practice, and it's rooted in the law of Moses.